Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
I want to start with college basketball and how important was this weekend and what we saw in the Elite Eight for just the sport of college basketball. Now, I've been saying this the last couple of years, and hey, I do 82 NBA games a year. I was in San Antonio last night doing a Kings and Spurs game, and I had a monitor in front of me keeping my eye on the end of the Duke-Michigan State game, because I'm just like, okay, these games are too good to miss. I don't care if I'm doing a live event or what. I've got to have it on in front of me. And it was you just can't miss it. The end of these games in the Elite Eight were incredible. But before we get to the matchups and we talk about how incredible of a story it is for Texas Tech when they lose all of their top scorers seemingly from a year ago and they're able to do what they did. And then you look at Auburn without their best player and they're able to beat that Kentucky squad. And I'm going to get into Kentucky and Duke because I want to ask you clones, should they have more hardware than they have? I mean, and we'll get into that in a moment. But talk about the sport of college basketball, one and dones. You know, we talk about Zion Williamson now apparently he's going to be heading into the NBA. You get a chance to see him for a couple of months, and then he's gone. How good was this weekend for the sport of college basketball? For any of the detractors or any of those that, well, the quality of college basketball has gone down. The quality of the play in the is not nearly as good. Hey, if you watch this weekend and you watch the Elite Eight games, I don't know how anybody can say that now about college basketball. Where do you want to start? I think you got to start with Texas Tech, right? And the job that Chris Beard has done. And raise your hand. Raise your hand if you had Texas Tech back when the season began in November, going to the final, all the players they lost from a year ago, they have been able to do. And Chris Beard down, talk about what this means in that community with this team and the way they just absolutely suffocate teams with defense. You know, they say defense doesn't win in championships. If Texas Tech is able to win and they are able to beat Michigan State and then win on Monday night a week from tonight, defense will win championships. So we're going to talk about all the matchups. I'll get into that with John Rothstein at the top of hour number two. But that, to me, you start right there with Texas Tech. You start with the fact that they are going to their first ever Final Four. Then you get to Auburn and Bruce Pearl. They're without their best player. And they controlled the game. Their tempo. They want to run. They're like up and down, up and down. And you know what's been the difference for them? Their defense has been impressive in this tournament. Towards the end of the year, when they got on a little bit of a run, you know, when you think of Auburn, you think of their tempo and you think of how fast and they try to strike quickly because they want to run. They want to get the ball and go. How good has their defense been? Go ask Kentucky and go ask those players because when they needed the stops, they got the stops and they got the rebounds. And then you talk about a team like Michigan State. Tom Izzo, right? Don't we go through this every year? Well, I'm not going to pick Michigan State. Well, they don't have that. And then you know what? You get down to this time of year, and it's Tom Izzo and the Michigan State Spartans. And what Winston has done and how good of a player he is. And now all of a sudden, you take a look at that matchup with Texas Tech's defense and Michigan State and how impressive they are with their interior defense. These matchups coming up this weekend, contrasting styles, new teams with an Auburn and a Texas Tech, and then Virginia. Hey, Charlottesville. Hey, everybody down in Virginia. The Cavaliers have been the best college basketball team in the land for the last 6 years. And they have nothing to show for it. Last year was an embarrassment. And how this team, in that situation, when they needed a miracle, they get the miracle to send the game to overtime, and Tony Bennett finally is able to break through. We know how Virginia plays. They want to take you out of what you do best. They're going to find what you do best, and they're going to take you out of it. And they held on. They are now, are they the team to beat this weekend? Is this the time for Virginia They grind it out. They go in a half court, and they just beat you up. So here we have it, Auburn and Virginia and Texas Tech and Michigan State. All right, here's another part of this story that I want to get into. And I'm going to ask John about this coming up at the start of hour number two. I didn't realize this until I was sitting at Rupp Arena a couple of years ago. I do the Sacramento Kings games on TV, and we played back-to-back years in the preseason in Lexington. And I'm sitting there on the floor at Rupp Arena, and I'm looking at all of the banners hanging from the rafters. And I'm looking at all of the SEC championships, and then I'm all of a sudden, then I'm looking at the national championship banners. And I'm looking up, and I see the 2012, and I'm like, wait a minute. The championship before Anthony Davis was not until 1998. Now, as I said, I've been doing the NBA for 31 years. And every single night when I'm doing a game, whether I'm doing the game with my broadcast partner, Jerry Reynolds, or now Doug Christie, we talk about all the players on the rosters from Kentucky. Go look at any NBA roster and look at all the players from Kentucky. How is it that John Calipari, all right, has won one championship? Now, he has gotten to four Final Fours. But how is it that Kentucky is an NBA hotbed? All the top players in the country want to go play for Cal, right? Because they know they're going to be in the NBA. Go just pick up any roster at random. How is it that Kentucky has only won national championship since 1998? Coach, you want to explain that to me? Folks in Lexington, you want to call me up and tell me how Kentucky has only won championship since 98? How is it that Kentucky, and I'll get to Duke in a minute, with all of those players that go into the NBA every single year, don't get to the podium when it's all said and done? How is it that a team like Kentucky has so much of a problem with their talent winning six consecutive games? Is that the parity in college basketball? Is that what makes this tournament a must-see every March and now in the first week of April? Because a team like Kentucky, who's got the best talent year in, year out, all you got to do, as I said, look at the NBA rosters, and yet they can't win. All right, now what about Coach K? If you look at 2010, from there, two titles in two trips to the Final Four. Should Duke have more to show than they do? Because a lot of people want to get on Cal. A lot of people want to get on John Calipari. And I'm one of them. You know, to me, if you have that type of talent going into the NBA every year, I know Cal hasn't been there since 98, but are you going to tell me that Kentucky shouldn't have more than one championship since 98 with the players that they send into the league every single year? It's pretty amazing to me. I don't know. And you look at Texas Tech, and you look at a team like Auburn. I mean, if you're John Calipari in Kentucky, if you watch the entirety of that game, are you going to tell me that Bruce Pearl did not out-coach John Calipari? Because he sure as heck did. He sure did. There's no doubt about it. I mean, you're Kentucky. You've got to win that game. You have to win that game without the best player playing for Auburn, and you still cannot win that game. You can check out his great website at LandryFootball.com. Chris, Grant Napier, thanks for being on the Jim Rome Show. How are you today? Chris, can you hear me?
Hey, there we go. Grant, I can. Great to be with you as always.
All right, so here we are, and I want to take you back to last year, because last year at this time, nobody, or at least that I was aware of, thought Baker Mayfield or had Baker Mayfield going to the Cleveland Browns, and then all of a sudden, he's with the Browns. So grade the top quarterbacks from your viewpoint. Grade the top quarterbacks in this draft for me. Who has the highest grade?
Well, to me, I think they're a little different, because you've got in Kyler Murray a unique type of quarterback that's definitely short, but he's got playmaking ability. I don't think he's for everybody. I think Dwayne Haskins is more the dropback guy that's a better passer. And I think on most people's boards, he's going to be the number one guy, including my board. But I think Kyler Murray's a guy that you've got to embrace what he is. And that's a little bit different than any other quarterback in this league. He's you know, maybe built a little bit like Russell Wilson. The upside is that maybe he can be a shorter version of what Patrick Mahomes is. Is he as good a passer as Patrick? No. But I think that's kind of what you have to look at is if he fits in, you can embrace that spread style, he can be very effective. But I think Dwayne Haskins is the best quarterback in this draft in terms of a guy that's very accurate, make plays in the pocket. He just doesn't have a lot of experience. I think a guy like Daniel Jones of Duke will make it and be a good player in time if developed. And I think Drew Lock has some ability as well.
Clones cannot wait to tell you about one of our new partners here in the jungle, Outer Known. Outer Known is a company founded by pro surfer and 11-time world champion Kelly Slater. I'm guessing anybody listening right now would agree on one thing. My man's got the look. My man looks great. So when I had an opportunity to partner up with a company that makes clothing that was founded by Kelly Slater, that was a no-brainer. I have the clothes. I broke them out at home. The wife thought that I looked cool. My kids thought that I looked awesome. Went down to Newport Beach rocking a sweater the other day. Man, I felt good and got compliments. You see, finding high-quality clothes that fit great is not always easy. Plus, this is a company with a mission to provide great clothing that does not harm the environment. Outer Known clothes are for people and planet. High quality, sustainable clothes, durable construction, and a great fit. Outer Known only works with factories that pay fair living wages and provide safe working conditions. And again, the clothing looks great and it fits great. Go to outerknown.com today, enter my code ROME at checkout, and you'll get 25% off your full price order. Once again, outerknown.com, outerknown.com. Remember to use my code name ROME at checkout and get 25% off. Check them out today, outerknown.com. Do not forget the promo code ROME, and get 25% off.
It seems that every year when a general manager wants a player, particularly a quarterback, we see the movement. We saw it 2 years ago with the Bears when they flip-flopped one spot to make sure they got Mitchell Trubisky. So if Haskins is the best quarterback, in your opinion, on the board, and there are some teams out there that desperately need a QB, do you see the movement of a team like the Giants or a team in that neighborhood moving up to get him?
I don't know that the Giants are going to do it because, again, I don't know how they'll have him graded. Now, let's say, and again, I think these guys can play, but somebody's going to like Haskins. And, yes, I do think somebody's going to move up. Maybe it's not the Giants, but, you know, maybe it's a Miami that's looking for a quarterback. Maybe it's a Denver. Maybe it's Cincinnati who's looking for their quarterback of the future. I think we need to keep an eye out on those teams. The Giants, you know, it really depends. I mean, it depends upon who they like. I wouldn't be surprised if the Giants have a pretty decent grade on a guy like Daniel Jones, stay where they are, take the defensive player, and then maybe take somebody like Daniel Jones a little bit later in the first round. So I think it just depends on two things. How do they have these quarterbacks graded? I may like them, but it doesn't matter what I think. If they're really high on their board, I think you can count on at least a couple of those teams moving up because we see it every year.
All right, San Francisco at number two. We keep on hearing Nick Bosa. Is he the highest-rated defensive player on your board?
He is. He and Quinnen Williams. I think it comes down to what is their medical grade on Nick Bosa. Listen, he's fine. He's over the injury, but you have to make a determination. Is he a chronic injury issue? I think he's the best fit. He's an edge guy. If they have concerns about it medically, then I could see them going with Quinnen Williams. But they've taken a lot of interior guys in the past. Nick Bosa would make a whole lot of sense there.
All right, let's talk about the Raiders because they have a lot of picks. I'm a little puzzled by some of the moves they've made and the money that they have spent so far in the offseason. What's your take on what they're doing?
Well, listen, I think there's a heavy impact on defensive front players in this draft. And if you're a team like the Raiders and you don't come out of this with an impact defensive, you know, player that can rush the passer, then they're in a lot of trouble. Now, I know people are saying, no, you let Khalil Mack out the door, and they did. So, to me, somebody like a Josh Allen of Kentucky makes a lot of sense. You know, they could go in a different direction. You can get an interior player like an Ed Oliver. If somebody like Bosa or Williams were to slip, I think it wouldn't take long for them to get the card up. So, I think they're in good shape there and that they're going to be an impact player. But if you look at how it may fall, somebody like Josh Allen, the edge rusher from Kentucky, makes a whole lot of sense.
We are talking with Chris Landry, LandryFootball.com, right here on the Jim Rome Show. Odell Beckham is going to be talking to the media here shortly. They have been very busy this offseason. Your take on the Cleveland Browns, the direction they're going in, and will it all work?
Well, I think they've certainly been aggressive. I think John Dorsey's done a good job. You know, they had a lot of picks and a lot of cap room. I think they've used it to be aggressive and try to, you know, move this team forward. I think that they're certainly better than they've been, and I think they can be legitimate contenders in that division. I would hold off and pump the brakes on all the, well, they go on to the Super Bowl talk, but I think that they can make a run at the playoffs. What it does for me in that going into this draft is that they've got a pretty good, they've got their quarterback, as you've alluded to, pretty good. Their backs are pretty good. I think they could maybe add an offensive lineman, but they're still pretty solid there. They've got two really good receivers and some complements to that and a tight end that can stretch the field. And defensively, they're not a bad team at all. So I think they're in a position to go and kind of let their draft board speak to them and get an impact player. And, you know, I think they're on their way to, I think, doing some really good things. You know, it's amazing how the whole dynamics of an organization changes, Grant, when you have a quarterback, because you can kind of put them into two categories. Ones that have their quarterback and just can go take the best player are the ones that are just every year searching for a quarterback until they can find one, and at least the Browns are out of the quarterback shopping business.
You are very involved with the scouting combine in Indianapolis. You're very involved in scouting and everything that has to do with evaluating talent, and yet every year there are picks that are made in the top 10 that end up being bad picks when you look up at the draft 2 or 3 years later. What do you think is the main reason that evaluating NFL talent is so difficult and why there are so many mistakes made?
Well, I think the reason is people tend to reach for need. They tend to think, okay, we've got to have this, so let's go ahead and draft this guy. And there's a lot in the organization. I think the organizations are run a little differently today. And in my day, it was really football people, people with coaching and scouting backgrounds that were evaluating players. And not that we didn't make mistakes, we did. But now you're getting a lot of non-football people, people that or don't come from a coaching and scouting background, haven't spent years and years on the road scouting. And you get a lot of this. Well, we need to make this splash. We need to get this guy. And they buy into a lot of that. And that's where the huge mistakes are made. And then the other thing I think combined with that is the fact that the lack of stability in an organization contributes to these guys being busts. For example, you take a guy and you think he's a great fit in your 4-3 defense and you're one gap penetrating, an under front, and then you change coaches in 2 years. Oh, we don't want that. We want guys that are more two-gap guys, and we're going to run maybe base 3-front with a 30 front with an edge rusher. Well, then all of a sudden the guys that you drafted 2 years ago that were really good fit for one system are not good fits now. And so if you look at it, the teams that lack stability, that are constantly trying to, well, let's fire the coach and let's fire the GM and let's do this differently, it's like building a house where you never actually move into the house. You're constantly tearing down the walls and building it up again. So I think it's the combination of that, which is why I think good, patient organizations that hire well and have a system in place, they evaluate players with an understanding of that system. The system stays in place for a long time. And guess what? You develop players within that system. Well, go figure. I mean, you're going to have more success as opposed to if you're constantly changing your system and your philosophy. And, you know, the new guy says, well, I didn't draft that guy. I don't want that guy. I'm not responsible for that guy. Well, you never end up building towards something. So that's why we have so many mistakes today.
You talk a lot about impact players, and I think a lot of people think of impact players at the skill position or an edge rusher or a standout defensive player. And then I look at a guy like Quentin Nelson a year ago. He was a huge impact, in my opinion,
yes,
on the Colts offensive line. So define to the fans your vision of an impact player.
Well, you just hit it. In fact, Quentin Nelson was the highest graded. I had the highest graded player on my draft board last year. And the reality is there's a priority in terms of importance to winning football games. Like Nelson, he was, I thought, the best player in last year's draft. It does not mean he should have been the first pick taken, because a great guard doesn't have the impact of a really good pass rusher or a really good quarterback or a really good playmaker at receiver. That's just the reality of it. So to me, an impact player is a guy that comes in and has an impact in any way. If all things are equal, I'm going to take the priority position, quarterback if you need one, a guy that can score touchdowns, a guy that can rush the quarterback or have an impact, either that defensive tackle, defensive end, maybe even a great corner. But that's the priority in terms of positions. But I do not take a lesser player over a better player, even if he is at a non-traditional great impact spot like offensive guard or center, you know, left tackles are a tougher thing to find. So the draft is like anything else. It's supply and demand. And so you can't find a Quentin Nelson, you know, every day, but you can find good guards even as late rounders. So I think that factors in to why people make some of these decisions and why, in some cases, they miss on better players to take lesser players to fit more positions of need that we just discussed.
All right, let's talk about Josh Rosen. Obviously, if the Cardinals are going to take Kyler Murray, he would be on the move. We've heard so many rumors. Two things here. Where did you have him in the evaluation process a year ago? And how do you evaluate a quarterback that was in his first year behind arguably the worst offensive line in football?
I had him behind Darnold. I had him behind Baker. My concern about Josh has never been anything physically. It's how committed is he to football? You know, I believe you have to love and live the game, and you have to have a great capacity to learn, which he has. But is it a great willingness to learn? I think he's just adequate in that area. The answer to your question is, when you evaluate him, you have to look at it this way. You have to evaluate him as if he was coming out of college. You go back to your college evaluation on him. You can't look at a whole lot of what he did in the NFL, although you look at it. You have to factor in the fact that the offensive line was bad. The defense wasn't very good. It was a bad football team, as you alluded to. You don't look at the overall result. I mean, the whole thing, when I hear people say, oh, this guy won this and that, quarterbacks don't win games. He can only do so much. So you have to evaluate the player within the team concept. I think you have to go back to your work that you did on him as a college player and then add on top of that some of the things you may have gleaned through the tape. Here's the thing to keep in mind. What is going to be the cost to get him? The Cardinals are going to do everyone that would be interested in him in a favor. They paid him the signing bonus. They paid him $10 million. You don't have to pay that. All it's going to cost you, you're going to get him on a rookie contract, and whatever it's going to cost you, it's going to be in terms of a draft pick or a player if you can work out a trade. You're not going to have to owe him any money, and he's going to be under a rookie contract. So if it doesn't cost you a whole lot, I mean, for example, if you can get him for a third round, maybe a late second round, you can look at it from a risk-reward standpoint. It's not much risk, because let's say he doesn't develop. Well, you're not giving up a whole lot of cap capital. There's not a whole lot of risk. If you like him, if you liked him coming out in last year's draft, it's going to cost you a lot less than taking him last year, because the Cardinals are not going to get a first-round pick on him for him. You might be able to get him for a late two or a third, and if you do that, I think in some cases it may be worth a risk if you liked him. If you liked him and you felt like, you know, this kid does have a gene to want to be a great football player, if you believe in him that way, I don't think there's anything else that would steer me away from him.
Chris, great stuff. Really appreciate your time. Have a good day.
Thanks, Grant. Appreciate you. Take care.
All right.
When you need auto parts but you cannot get to a store, visit O'ReillyAuto.com. You can buy your parts online and pick them up in the O'Reilly Auto Parts store of your choice. No shipping costs, easy returns, and convenient pickup on your schedule. Shop your way for the parts that you need at O'ReillyAuto.com. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day.
Well, if you didn't like that Elite Eight, you don't like college basketball. Unbelievable. John Rothstein, college basketball insider for CBS Sports, is going to try to break it down for us. John, good to talk to you. How are you, man?
Great, Grant. Great to be with you.
All right. I'm going to give you the stage, and I'm going to let you start wherever you want, because this may have been the best Elite Eight weekend that we've seen in a long, long time.
Grant, pound for pound, inch for inch, the best Elite Eight weekend I have seen, you know, without question. You know, there was others that came to mind as being potentially in the mix as good, but nothing compared to this. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, every game, with the exception of Texas Tech Gonzaga, you felt like any team could win. I never felt really in the last 5 minutes that Gonzaga was going to win the game. Sunday's game were absolutely sensational. Auburn being in a situation where they beat Kentucky in a regional final without a healthy Chuma Okeke. And then what can you say about what we witnessed between Virginia and Purdue on Saturday night? For Kihei Clark to have the presence of mind to make that pass to Mamadi Diakite and not force up a three for the win in the final couple seconds speaks to his poise. Just still trying to come down from the high that we saw this weekend, Grant.
All right, let's talk more about Virginia first, because you could make the argument that they've been as good as anybody in college basketball the last 6 years, but have had nothing to show for it. What was the difference getting to the Final Four this year, John?
Experience, again, the talent in college basketball, and there's going to be, you know, a couple of stigmas, you know, out there for all intents and purposes, you know, that talent sometimes still trumps experience. You know, I don't think that's the case, because one-and-done teams are still struggling, you know, for all intents and purposes, to get over the hump and get to a Final Four and win a national championship. Now, I think when you see all these different scenarios unfolding, you are going to see, obviously, the 2012 Duke team and the 2015 Kentucky team as examples that had one-and-done and won a national title. The 2012 Kentucky team had Deron Lamb, Darius Miller, and Terrence Jones, who all played in the Final Four a year before. Deron Lamb was their leading scorer in the 2012 national title game. And Quinn Cook, Emile Jefferson, and Matt Jones are in a scenario in 2015 where they're all playing major roles on that one-and-done team. Mike Krzyzewski and Jeff Capel is the top assistant on that Duke team, both told me in separate conversations since 2015 that Quinn Cook was not the best player on that Duke team, but it was definitely the most important.
John, let's talk about Texas Tech. And I look at all of the scores that they lost from a year ago and what they did this year. And again, I bet you the majority of fans, and I'm not talking about the hardcore college basketball fans, wouldn't be able to tell you anything about Texas Tech at the beginning of the season. What a year. What a job that Chris Beard has done. And they do it with defense. I just love the way they defend. What sticks out to you about this team?
Well, I think the biggest thing you need to look at when you evaluate, you know, Texas Tech is the fact that they've got four new starters from the team a year ago that lost to Villanova in the Elite Eight. Now, this is the interesting thing about this Texas Tech team. Two of the players who are currently starting right now for Texas Tech, Tariq Owens and Matt Mooney, were not in the program a year ago because they were grad transfers at their respective schools, obviously St. John's, and, you know, Matt Mooney came from a lower level. So think about that for a second, Grant. These guys weren't even in the program. 1 year later, they're in a situation where their starters on a Final Four team. That, to me, is the most remarkable.
John, at the beginning of the tournament, I heard you on with Jim the day after the brackets in the first hour, and you were talking about Duke, and you were talking about their talent, but you also pointed out that they're not a good three-point shooting team. And, you know, I cover the NBA, and you cannot win in the NBA if you don't shoot the three. And now you can't win in college basketball without shooting the three, can you?
No, you definitely can. And I think, you know, another thing you need to take into consideration is, you know, one thing is when you also don't have a three-point shooter, you're in a scenario where, you know, you're going to see different schemes. You're going to see different scenarios. You are going to be in an area where you're going to be like Duke against UCF, and that's where they forced Trey Jones and Goldwire to make the scenario where they're going to have to make shots to keep the defense honest. And that's what they did. In that game, it wasn't enough, obviously, against Michigan State.
Talk to me about Kentucky. They've only won one championship since 1998. Is the criticism, and John Calipari hasn't been there since 98, is the criticism fair that they have not won enough and put enough banners up while John Calipari's been there, considering all of the players that he sends into the NBA every year?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. You know, I think if you're a Kentucky fan today, that's really difficult right now, Grant, is this. You have a scenario, if you're a Kentucky fan, where they have now bowed out in the NCAA tournament in back-to-back years, where the other team that they were playing didn't have, for all intents and purposes, a key cog in their attack. Kansas State last year did not have a healthy Dean Wade. Auburn did not have a healthy Chuma Okeke. That's something that, again, is going to be tough for the Kentucky fan to swallow. I mean, yesterday was not a good day for the Blue Bloods, Grant. I mean, you look at the scenario for Duke and Kentucky. Duke and Kentucky did not have a good Sunday. And Duke right now is in a scenario, and I know they were really close in back-to-back years of going to a Final Four, but Duke in the last 3 years have had Jason Tatum, Luke Kennard, Harry Giles, also Trayvon Duval, Grayson Allen, Marvin Bagley, Wendell Carter, Gary Trent Jr., yep, R.J. Barrett, Zion Williamson, Trey Jones, and Cam Reddish, and they haven't gotten to a Final Four.
That's a great point. Hey, listen, they were lucky to beat Central Florida last week. All right, let's talk about the semis. Let's start with Auburn and Virginia. We know Auburn wants to get the ball and go. Virginia likes to take you out of what you do best, grind it out. Your thoughts on this matchup in the first game?
Great contrast to styles, a team that wants to play fast and over the top in Auburn, and obviously a Virginia team that is known for playing slow, playing methodical. Auburn not at full strength. It's the typical vintage contrast of styles game. Auburn wants to play faster than anybody else in college basketball, and they're going to have to go over the top of the defense to win this game. Auburn is in a scenario where they were, I think, fortunate to beat Kentucky yesterday because of the brilliance of Harper and Brown combining for 50 of the team's 77 points. But the most surprising thing to me in that game, Grant, was this. You have a scenario where Auburn wins the game against Kentucky. They don't go over the top of Kentucky's defense. Only made 7 threes. They're going to have to make a lot more than 7 threes to beat Virginia coming up Saturday night in Minneapolis.
Yeah, we're talking about college basketball with John Rothstein, college basketball insider CBS Sports, and then the nightcap, Texas Tech, with the way they play defense. Michigan State, very good interior defense, standout player, obviously, in Winston. Who wins this game?
I've got Michigan State, and I got Michigan State and Virginia in the title game, and I got Virginia winning the whole thing.
All right, talk to me about college basketball and what this weekend did, because I got to tell you, from my viewpoint, John, I've been a little critical of the play, and I think it's lagged a little bit the last couple of years. How important was this past weekend for the game of college basketball?
Well, I think, you know, the casual fan, the people from the periphery, might look at what we have in the Final Four and say there's not the brand name programs, with the exception of Michigan State and Virginia, that we normally have. But I think the basketball fan could see two outstanding games coming up in Minneapolis. When you look at the dynamics in these two games, we've already highlighted the great contrast in styles between Virginia and Auburn. On the other side, though, you've got a Michigan State-Texas Tech game, Grant, that looks like it could be played in a boxing ring versus a basketball court. This is a scenario where you have two teams that are physical, two teams that rebound, and you have the old guard in Tom Izzo against a coach in Chris Beard, who 6 years ago was not a part of Division I basketball. That, to me, is the most amazing thing of this Final Four. 6 years ago in 2013, Bruce Pearl and Chris Beard are not a part of Division I basketball. They're in a scenario right now where they're both coaching in their first Final Four. The same thing can be said for Tony Bennett. These three guys are going to be in a scenario where they are in the Final Four for the first time. Then you've got the old guard, Tom Izzo, trying to win a second national championship. Really nice storyline.
You know, John, a year ago we talked so much about the poor officiating in the tournament. Listen, I'm not sitting here saying it's easy. I think the officials get ragged on too much. But with that said, your evaluation, give me your overall thoughts, what you saw to this point with the way the games have been called.
I think there's been a lot of, you know, unfortunate things. I mean, I think you look at the end of the Texas Tech and Zaga game, Tariq Owens made a heck of a play, but, you know, that obviously wasn't the right call. You also saw a kickball that gave Gonzaga an opportunity to cut the deficit with Josh Perkins there late, you know, put Gonzaga in a situation to get closer down the stretch maybe than it should have been. I think, you know, we've got to do something about the officiating. We also have to do something about these replays at the end of games. It's taking away from the overall experience, and it's hurting, I think, the final couple of minutes of these games, Grant. Definitely something to look at.
All right, before I let you go, I have to ask you about Tom Izzo. Just seemingly lives for the big moment, comes through with the big moments, and what he has done at Michigan State. I say Tom Izzo, you say what?
Consistency, culture, and an unwilling desire to not let built-in excuses exist in his program. Grant, Michigan State doesn't just have its starting shooting guard from the beginning of the year out for the season, Josh Langford. It also has its backup to its starting shooting guard out for the year in Kyle Arns. I don't know many programs that could have sustained that, won the Big Ten regular season title, won the Big Ten tournament title, and then beaten Duke in a regional final. That's why Tom Izzo is who he is. And his face and the moment yesterday when Duke fell to Michigan State, the disbelief, the shock, the joy, there is no better image that can be synonymous with what March Madness is all about than what we saw from Tom Izzo.
No disrespect to anybody that is a fan of one of the four teams. You think Virginia-Michigan State's the best final we could have?
From, I think, a matchup perspective,
yes,
but and I think a matchup perspective for the casual fan, people know Izzo, people know Tony Bennett, but I think if you look at the dynamic right now, outside the box a little bit, there are two programs going to the Final Four for the first time ever in Texas Tech and Auburn, and they're not going to go, knowing the coaches as well as I do, they're not going on this trip for the party. They're going to win a national championship.
John, enjoy Minneapolis. We appreciate the time. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Grant.
Steve Sands.
Good to be with you, Grant. How are you, man?
I am doing good. I know everyone wants to talk about Tiger, but I've got to ask you about Rory McIlroy, because I thought what he did at the Players Championship, and I watched the interview he had with your colleagues afterwards, and I thought it was a very forthcoming interview and his perspective on how he views things. And then he has the blow up on 16 on Saturday, and just boom, just it's gone. Where's his game right now? How do I read what's happened to him in a span of 2 weeks?
Oh, I think he's the best player in the world right now. I think he's playing the best, along with maybe Dustin Johnson. I think those two are the favorites going into the Masters next week. If Rory's putter cooperates with the rest of his game, Grant, I think that Rory's going to be just fine at Augusta as he tries to, you know, get that fourth leg of the Grand Slam. But everything's got to be all systems go for him. It was a couple of weeks ago at the Players. He was doing just fine until 16 against Tiger Woods the other day on Saturday morning, but he had a really, really bad shot, and he admitted it was a bad shot at a really bad time. I'm not one to say someone choked. Who knows what goes through someone's mind, but I think Rory, when his game is on, which it is right now, I think Rory's the best player in the world.
All right, you talked about Dustin Johnson. And yet, when I've watched, and I haven't watched every shot that he's made, but it seems like his putter has been deficient. Give me your thoughts on the game.
Well, I think it's like Rory. I think if the putter cooperates, you know he's going to be able to hit the ball. You know the ball striking is going to be there. So if the putter cooperates, if it happens to be his week or his day, then I think he'll be just fine. Look, Dustin has an opportunity every single week to do what he did in Mexico 7 weeks ago. He can absolutely dominate a field. He can take over a tournament. He won that event by, I think, 6 shots. The third place guy, I think, was 4 or 5 back from that. So I think it was like a 10-shot spread from him to the third place guy against the best field this season on tour. I think Dustin Johnson, like I said, he and Rory McIlroy right now, to me, are the two best players in the world.
Steve Sands, studio host, does the play-by-play, does everything for the Golf Channel and NBC Sports. How do you assess Tiger Woods' game right now?
I think it's good. I think it was a little rusty last week after taking a week off after the Players. I think that the week off, this coming week right now that we're in, will help him going into next week's Masters. But I just, you know, he's not razor sharp, right? I don't think he can be razor sharp, because he doesn't play often enough. And it's hard for him at 43 years of age with a beaten-up body to play golf, you know, the way he used to, 3-4 weeks in a row, 3 out of 4 weeks, 4 out of 5 weeks, that kind of thing. It's difficult, and it gets harder as he gets older. It gets harder as all of the guys get older. But I think his game is good enough to contend. I just don't know if he's going to put it together all 4 days at Augusta. But if there is a major he's going to win this year, I think that's the one.
Okay, with that said, with the schedule in the golf calendar and the majors being condensed, does that work against him?
No, I don't think it works against him, Grant. Not this time. I think that when they're more spread out, I think it works against him because he... So let's just take example. You have the Masters next week. Well, 5 weeks later, you have the PGA at Bethpage Black in May. So what I think is going to take place is he's going to play 1 or 2 times. If it was 2 months like it normally has been until the next major, the U.S. Open being Father's Day weekend, you know, there's a chance where he only plays like three times in like 9 weeks, whereas I think in a five-week stretch, he can skip a week, play the next week, skip a week, and then play the PGA. So I don't think the condensed schedule hurts him for the majors. Where I think it hurts him is, like, he didn't play the Honda Classic this year. He played Mexico City, took the Honda off, and also took Bay Hill off. So then he came to the Players, and he hadn't played a lot. So I don't think the major championship schedule will hurt him in this condensed schedule.
Last that we talked was in Lake Tahoe, and you were covering the celebrity golf tournament for NBC. And I asked you about Tiger Woods, and we both agreed that he would not win another major. And then when he went on and had a strong summer, ended up winning the Tour Championship in a field of 30. As right. you've watched his improvement, has your opinion changed in that regard?
It hasn't. I think that Tiger could win at any point. I just don't think it's going to happen. And here's why. Again, I just don't think against a full field, meaning 144 players, maybe 120 players at an invitational or 156 players. In a full field, I don't think he's going to be the best player after 4 days amongst every player in the field. When he won the Tour Championship, and this is not a discount or a knock by any means, but it was against 29 other guys. So half the field is eliminated, basically, after getting off to a poor start. So I thought that was a perfect storm for him. End of the year, I thought it was really good. It was a great win, obviously, but it was a great scenario for him to win.
With everything,
I just don't think in a major that's going to happen. But if it does, Grant, it's going to happen, I think, at the Masters, where there are a lot fewer players in the field, only about 90 or so, 95 and change, as opposed to the U.S. Open, the PGA, and the Open, where there's a full 156. I just don't see that scenario taking place for him.
You know, when Tiger was at the top of the game, we get the fact that the game of golf exploded. And then when he went on his decline, I think some people pulled away. And now his resurgence, his importance to TV ratings, attendance, interest in the game, has got to be unparalleled, right?
Well, you and I have talked about this before, on and off the air. I don't think, in my 28 years of being a sportscaster, I don't think there's ever been anybody who's had more of an effect on the ratings of his or her sport like Tiger has. That includes Jordan. The NBA ratings are still through the roof, all right? When Tiger doesn't play, I mean, that's without Michael Jordan. They were great with him, and they're still great without him.
Yep.
That's no knock on Jordan. It just that's kudos to the game and the league and the way they've run their business. Golf is different. Golf is more of a niche sport. And Tiger brings – we're all going to watch golf who are golf fans and pretty much sports fans at the big events. What happens with Tiger is he brings everybody to the TV set. Everybody wants to know what's going on when Tiger's in the mix. So golf is very healthy. It's in a fantastic spot. They have a lot of good young stars who are really good guys. But the stardom that Tiger brings will never be duplicated by anybody else. He has an effect on ratings more than anybody who's ever played any sport, man or woman. It's amazing.
All right. So with that said, not to think that we're ever going to see another Tiger Woods, give me a young phenom that you think may be the next guy for a couple of years. We thought it was going to be Jordan Spieth, and then he tailed off a little bit. Who's the next guy coming up that we should keep our eye on?
Well, I don't know if there's anybody who has not won a major yet who I think is going to win a whole gajillion bunch of majors. What I do think great is, and I'm convinced of this, and I keep saying it, if McIlroy can win the Masters, if he can get that fourth of the four Grand Slam wins, which is so hard to get, I think it will open the door for him to then go on and win 10, 12, 13 majors. But that pressure is so immense, so difficult, that I don't know if he's going to allow himself, if that makes any sense, or free himself up enough to be able to go do it. I do think if he wins the Masters in the next 2 years, I think he's going to win a bunch of not only Masters, but a bunch of other major championships. And he already has four. I'm not saying he's going to get 10 more and catch Tiger at 14, but I really think that McIlroy is the best of all of these guys to go out and win those four tournaments every single year.
You do this every week. You're with these guys. You cover them. And I brought up the name of Jordan Spieth. And a couple of years ago, you know, the Masters, we see what he did at Chambers Bay and winning the Open. So what has happened? And I know he's still relevant and he's still good, but what is it about Jordan Spieth where it looked like he was that guy that was going to take over the game, that was on that pedestal, who's come down a couple of notches?
You know, I think that the putter has betrayed him. He putted in 2015 when he was winning those majors, and that couple of years there when he won his three majors.
Yeah.
Grant, he putted better than Tiger ever did in any year, ever. And Tiger would be the first one to admit that. So now there's a little bit of a correction. You're never going to be able to putt that great in this sport all the time. I mean, it's not, you know, Steph Curry's not losing his stroke. And golfers don't lose their stroke, but you just don't putt that well in this sport all the time. And he did for a long period of time. So there's a little correction there, like a stock market correction. And he needs to make up for that by hitting the ball closer, hitting the ball in better spots, giving himself better scoring opportunities that he doesn't have to rely on his putter so often to bail him out of trouble. And right now he's not doing that. So I think Jordan's going to be fine. He's a really good kid. He's very headstrong, very smart. His golf acumen's very high. He's a tough, tough kid. And he's obviously incredibly talented. I think he'll get through it, but he needs to gain some more confidence back. I think right now it's lacking a little bit.
And if it's okay, buddy, I hope it's not going to bother you that we're not going to talk about the Redskins or Giants during this interview.
Well, it's never going to bother me to not talk about the Giants. If you don't want to talk about the Skins, that's fine, too. You know, what are you going to do? When you've got a lousy owner and a lousy guy running the squad with Bruce Allen, you know, we have no chance of winning. But we are getting close to the Caps defending the Cup title here in a week and a half when the playoffs start. So we can talk hockey if you want, but football, we're no good right now.
Steve, great having you on. Enjoy next week. Keep up the great work. We'll talk to you soon.
Love you, Grant. Happy for all your success, bud.
The man is on line two. Brad in Corona. Where the heck have you been, dude?
Mr. Napier, how are you, my friend?
I'm not sure how I am. I got to hear what you have to say first.
Well, I really am enjoying you guest hosting today. It's been a while. I love following you and your lovely, way too hot for you wife, Star Napier, on Twitter. The more pictures I see of Star, the more convinced I am that my original assessment of why she's hanging out with you is 100% accurate, Grant. Star had her middle name legally changed to Star Primary Beneficiary Napier, which is ironic because not only is she getting all that money you got when you finally kicked the bucket, but in the meantime, she's the primary beneficiary of that massive hog you're wielding, Grant.
Oh, my gosh.
Good night now!